I'm very happy to introduce to you William Boyd. And William Boyd is the author of 10 works of fiction. And his first novel, A Good Man in Africa, was set in a fictional West African nation. And his last novel, Armadillo, was set in modern London. But he's also written various books about Africa. He's written about the Philippines. He's written about America in various of his novels. And he's also written for the screen and for television. He uses a very broad canvas in his work, and he's what I regard as geographically a generous writer and very ambitious. He writes novels of ideas, but also mystery novels, novels of thrills. There's a kind of cross-genre at work at in his fiction. He's been seen as a successor to writers like Evelyn Waugh and modernizers of writers like Evelyn Waugh and Kingsley Amis, although I'm not sure how you'd feel about that comparison, but it's certainly been made by other critics. But in any event, he's carved out his own fictional territory, and in my view, at least, he stands outside of the sort of literary pack, which is a very hard thing to do, to sort of find your own voice, to find your own land from which to sort of present literature. So to use one of his own kind of metaphors, he's out on the wing, the sort of lonely, beautiful wing on the playing field of the literary scene. And tonight, the format really will be that I think William will talk a little to you and also read from his new novel, which comes out in April of this year, or next year, sorry. And then we'll have a few questions between us, and then I'll open the discussion out to you. Okay, William Boyd, thank you.
Thank you very much. Very pleased to be here. This is a sort of world exclusive, believe it or not, but possibly a very frustrating one, in that I'm going to read to you from my new novel, which is coming out in April, and this is a bound proof of it. But there are not many of these in existence at the moment. So I'm testing the waters here in Warwick with great pleasure, and I hope you... I'll be very interested to see how you respond to it, put it that way. I should tell you a little bit about the book before I read my shortish extract. It's called Any Human Heart, and that title comes from an epigraph that I've chosen from Henry James, which goes, "Never say you know the last word about any human heart." This book is an attempt to try and pin down one human life, and the life in question is the life of a writer. Now, I swore a long time ago I'd never write a book about a writer, but you know, never say never, and here I am. I've become increasingly fascinated by certain literary types, I suppose. If you think of someone like Cyril Connolly, critic, bon viveur, lazy person. Another writer I really like, who's almost forgotten nowadays, called William Gerhardy, who was a hugely successful writer in the 1920s, regarded, Evelyn Waugh said, "I have talent, but he has genius. Who has heard of William Gerhardy today?" All his books, well, they just started to be reprinted again, but he lived out his life in total obscurity. His last book was published in 1940, and he died in 1977. So I think, I'm a writer. Imagine going for 37 years without publishing a book. And he was living in a flat near the BBC in almost total penury and completely total obscurity. And so I became sort of interested in that progression. And I invented this writer, and he's popped up in other works of mine before. And he's called Logan Mountstuart. And he appeared in a short story I wrote many years ago called Hotel des Voyageurs. And he also appeared in a very strange book, which has connections with this one, which was a spoof that I pulled off 2 or 3 years ago. I invented an American painter called Nat Tate and wrote a little book, which is a little artistic monograph illustrated with photographs and illustrations of Nat Tate's work. And for about 3 days, the art world of Manhattan believed he existed until it was exposed by a malicious British journalist. But the key source of information about Nat Tate was this English writer called Logan Mountstuart. And so Any Human Heart is, in a way, the story of Logan's life. And he was born in Montevideo, Uruguay, in 1906, half English, half Uruguayan, went to Oxford, just managed to get a third-class degree in history, became a man of letters, as you could do in those days. He had quite a generous allowance from his parents, got married, got divorced, there was a child, made a living writing reviews, the odd little shocking novel, and so on. Fell in love, got married again, knew a certain amount of success in the 1920s when he wrote a best-selling salacious novel called The Girl Factory. But then the career began its long slide downhill, only interrupted by World War II. And this is the bit I'm going to read you tonight. In the course of his life, Logan got to know many real people as well as many fictional people. He had a quite celebrated standoff with Virginia Woolf, for example. And one of the people he met on a house party in Scotland in the late 30s was Ian Fleming, creator of James Bond. World War II comes around. Logan is married to a very beautiful girl called Freya. They have a little daughter called Stella. He's a reader for a publishing house, earning £30 a week. Sales of his novels are diminishing. He's just scraping by. Hitler invades Poland in 1939, and Ian Fleming comes to his rescue. So I'll fill in little gaps as I go along, but I think I've set it up well enough for us to be able to follow the few pages that I'm going to read. Ian Fleming hadn't written any James Bond novels by 1939, but he was working for the Naval Intelligence Division. He was a spy, I suppose. And he offered Logan Mountstuart a job in Naval Intelligence because Logan, thanks to his Uruguayan heritage, could speak Spanish. I don't think there's any other names you need to know at the moment, but let's just start and see how we get along. One other thing I should say, yeah, it's very important. This book, in fact, I've got quite a few things to say now I remember. This book is written in the form of an intimate journal. Logan Mountstuart kept a erratic journal throughout his life, and we pick it up when he's 17 years old at boarding school in Norfolk, and it ends in the 1990s when he's living as a sort of semi-recluse in rural France. I don't know why I wanted to write a novel in the form of an intimate journal, particularly a novel that covers 80-odd years, or virtually most of the 20th century. It was quite a difficult task. And it was only in hindsight that I realized that this novel forms the third panel, if you like, of a triptych of books I've written. A book I wrote in 1987 called The New Confessions takes the form of a fake autobiography. A man called John James Todd is writing his life story and lying and embellishing and manipulating that story in order to make him appear in the best possible light. The little book I referred to earlier, Nat Tate, it takes the form of a fictional biography I am writing the biography of a non-existent American expressionist painter of the 1950s and 60s who committed suicide by jumping off the Staten Island ferry. And this book is the fake intimate journal. And all three forms are very distinct, even though they would seem to tend, you know, remorselessly towards the biographical, because when you write a journal, and I don't know how many of you do write journals, I mean, I write a journal, that day-by-day account of your life really doesn't look back and it doesn't look forward. It's so much rooted in the present, that it's a form that, now I've written this book, I realize is quite different from the biography or the autobiography. Those two forms are both looks backward at a life, trying to make sense of the various twists and turns and random events and moments of happiness and moments of tragedy. When you write a journal, you really don't know what's going to happen next. So when I wrote this novel, of course, I knew absolutely what was going to happen next, but I had to write it in a way that somehow reflected the kind of innocence of the journal form. And it was a strange and rather amazing experience. I had to live the life of Logan Mountstuart as he was living it, and put to one side my godlike knowledge of what was going to come of him. And when he died, as we all must die, it was a very sad moment, and I felt almost like his murderer. It was very strange. Anyway, here he is in 1939, beginning of World War II, happily married, young daughter, recruited by Ian Fleming into the Naval Intelligence Division, and about to face his first assignment. Here am I, editor, introducing it. True to his word, Ian Fleming was in touch during the first week of the war, and Logan Mountstuart was offered a job in the Naval Intelligence Division. This celebrated service was housed in the Admiralty buildings off the Mall, and was run in 1939 by Admiral John Godfrey. Fleming was his assistant. Mountstuart was created a lieutenant, special branch in the Royal Navy Volunteer Reserve. Within the organization of NID, he was attached to the propaganda department, with particular responsibility for monitoring intelligence coming out of Spain and Portugal, and was also instructed to come up with clever schemes to ensure that both countries stayed neutral. At first, this involved no more than the placing of anti-German stories, which had relevance to Spain and Portugal, in as many press outlets as possible. Mountstuart liked NID. It was a relaxed, faintly raffish, but proudly efficient institution. He also thought he looked very smart in his navy blue uniform, handmade at Byrne and Milner, with its undulating gold bands at the wrist. The keeping of a diary during wartime by serving men and officers was forbidden. Logan Mountstuart seems to have been aware of this, and the narrative flow is often interrupted until something of genuine interest happened to him. Monday, 8th July, 1940. Godfrey and Fleming called me and Vanderpoel in and asked if either of us knew Lisbon. I said yes, Vanderpoel no. At least one of you does, Godfrey said. Anyway, that's where you're heading. I inquired why. The Duke of Windsor has arrived there, Godfrey said, in flight from his house in France and the advancing German and Italian armies, and we need to keep an eye on him. Can't the embassy do that? Vanderpoel asked. I sensed he was reluctant to go. Apparently, the ambassador is a bundle of nerves, and the MI6 man there is a dipsomaniac and hated by all the staff. The position of the Duke was very delicate, Godfrey went on. He can't come back here because of the royal family, and we can't risk him falling into the hands of the Nazis. I said to Godfrey, you know, I met him once in Biarritz in 1934. Fleming looked at Godfrey as if he'd just won a bet. I told you Mountstuart was our man, he said mysteriously. So I went back to Freya, his wife, to relay the news. I said I'd be in no danger, but because it was Lisbon, She didn't seem to mind so much. Wednesday, 10th July. Lisbon. Vanderpool and I flew out in a Coastal Command Sunderland flying boat from Poole Harbour. Smooth, trouble-free flight. Lisbon seemed crammed with well-off refugees, all the riff-raff of Europe looking for safe passage out. For the first time, I felt strangely aware of Lisbon and Portugal being on the very edge of the old world. Here at its extremities, the terrified transients gathered, all looking out at the vast, refulgent ocean for some sign of security. We reported to the embassy, where we were coolly received by a man called Stopford, the so-called financial attaché, but actually the head of MI6 in Portugal, and were grudgingly briefed. The Duke and Duchess had fled their villa near Antibes on the 19th of June as the collapse of France gathered pace, and had travelled by road with their staff and some consular officials to Madrid. There they had spent 9 days being wined and dined before coming on to Portugal. They were currently living in the house of a Portuguese millionaire called Ricardo Espirito Santo in Cascais, about an hour's drive from the city. Stopford said, "I don't know what NID think they can do that we can't. We've got our people in the house. The grounds are hoaching with Portuguese police. He can't fart without us hearing about it." As we left, I said to Vanderpool, "What a boozer. Very comforting." "I thought he seemed very decent," Vanderpool said. I don't think our Vanderpool's cut out for intelligence somehow. We went back to our seedy hotel, which was all we could find, aptly called the London Pension, and Vanderpool took to his bed saying he thought he was coming down with the flu. Thursday, 11th July. Vanderpool running a temperature. "This evening I went to a drinks party at the embassy and met a man called Eccles, who seems to be some sort of eminence grise out here, very much in the know. Highly sceptical about the abilities of the embassy staff. He sees the Duke regularly, and I gained the impression that things were not going well. The Duke won't leave until he has had his future sorted out and certain guarantees have been given about his and the Duchess's status." "All very petty," Eccles said, given the appalling situation we're in. I repeated my old line about meeting the Duke in Beer Ritz, and Eccles practically embraced me. He immediately invited me out to dinner at the villa tomorrow night. "It was a very fleeting encounter," I said. "Couldn't matter less," Eccles said. "He's surrounded by dodgy financiers who are all talking to the dirt Germans. You'll be a breath of fresh air." Just popped in to see Vanderpool to tell him the latest development. He's outraged and has forbidden me to go. I said only Godfrey had that kind of authority. Wrote to Freya and told her I was to dine with David and Wallace. That should be some story to tell. Friday, 12th July. To reach the Duke's villa, the Bocca do Inferno, you drive almost to the furthest western point of Europe, or so it seems. He's staying in a big stucco house on a rocky promontory surrounded by pine trees. Ahead stretches the whole Atlantic Ocean. We pass through Belém and Estoril and followed the coast road to Cascais. Approaching Cascais, set back on a hill above the villa, we were stopped twice by police. They are clearly well guarded. As we drove through the gates, Eccles reminded me that a bow from the neck was suitable for the Duke, but the Duchess should receive nothing more than a smile and a handshake. On no account was I to refer to her as Her Royal Highness. I said I understood. The villa itself sits behind high stone walls and is large and comfortable with a swimming pool. Ricardo Espirito Santo and his wife Mary greeted us on the terrace where we were served drinks. There was another couple there by the name of Aseca. Then we waited and waited. There was a lot of covert watch glancing, and Mary Espirito Santo kept disappearing to whisper to the staff until eventually the Duke and Duchess of Windsor came down from their room. First impressions. They were both immaculately dressed. The Duke looked like a miniature American film star, slim and dapper, with his grey blonde hair swept back, a perfectly cut dinner suit, a cigarette casually poised in hand. The Duchess, who must be in her mid-40s, was equally petite. A beautifully matched porcelain couple. You wanted to put them on your mantelpiece. I towered over them both. The Duchess was heavily made up and heavily bejeweled. She has an expressionless mask-like face and a rather protuberant mole on her chin. Eccles introduced me when my turn came and mentioned Biarritz. We met on the golf course, sir, I said. You're a golfer, thank God, he turned to the Duchess. Darling, this dear fellow was at Biarritz in 34. Do you remember that holiday? Wasn't it fun? I adore Biarritz, she said. So do I said. In fact, I think, and he's a golfer, said the Duke. David, don't butt in like that, Mr. Mountstuart. Mr. Mountstuart was going to tell us something fascinating about Biarritz. Then we were interrupted and ushered into dinner. I sat beside Signora Aseca and Mary Espirito Santo, who was rather attractive in that cold, hard way certain rich European women have. Signora Aseca spoke Spanish and broken French. Mary Espirito Santo was fluent in English. Eccles and the Duchess laughed together a lot. They seemed very gay. I thought at the time, store this one away, Logan. The Duke and Duchess of Windsor, a lovely house on the sea, hot and cold running servants, good food and wine, the world at war. As we were leaving, the Duke came up to me and asked me if I was free to golf tomorrow afternoon at the Estoril Golf Club. I said, indeed I was, many thanks, etc. He lingered a bit, and I said it was good to see him in such fine form after his epic drive across Europe. His face slumped sulkily, and he lowered his voice. I'm a virtual prisoner here, he said. Nothing but blocking on all sides and mountains of red tape. I commiserated, and we agreed to meet at the club tomorrow at 3 o'clock. On the drive back to Lisbon, Eccles was intrigued to learn of the appointment. He thought for a while and said, I'd appreciate it, Mountstuart, if you'd let me know anything that goes back to NID. Of course, I said, then added, you haven't any idea where I can lay my hands on a set of golf clubs, have you? Saturday, 13th July. His Majesty's Government has generously procured me a new set of golf clubs, which is very decent of it, them. And thus equipped, I set out to the Estoril Golf Club for my game. The Duke Espirito Santo and another man called Brito e Cunha turned up half an hour late, and with them were about a dozen Portuguese detectives. The Duke said he would prefer to play a two-ball with me and urge the other two to tee off first. The day was warm, with a slight breeze off the sea. The course was baked hard, and the grass burnt tinder dry. My first drive leapt along the fairway as if it were bouncing on concrete for practically 300 yards. But the greens were watered and played well, if fast. The Duke was a 12 handicap and played a sober and risk-free game. At the third tee, we stopped for a cigarette as Espirito Santo and Cunha played on. I bounced my ball on the ground and it made a crack like a marble on asphalt. I'm told this is what golf's like in the tropics, I said. Well, I'll get plenty of practice soon enough, the Duke said glumly. I don't understand, sir. They're sending me to the Bahamas, he said. I'm going to be governor. Bahamas should be wonderful. Do you think they said that to Napoleon when they packed him off to St. Helena? The Duke was in a bad mood, but was playing good golf, and I was careful not to challenge his early two-hole lead. As his golf improved, so did his demeanour and his indiscretions. I sensed his relief at talking to a fellow Englishman and golfer. Some of the things he said. His brother, the king, was an amiable fool, completely dominated by his wife. It was the Queen who was preventing him, the Duchess, returning to Britain. Doesn't want us there, he said. Thinks we'll steal their thunder. Very jealous of Wallace. He was sick to death of Portugal and longing to leave, but would only go on my conditions. Two problems appeared to preoccupy him more than anything else. One was the recovery of certain possessions left at their houses in Antibes and Paris, clothes and linen. And the second was the refusal of the British government to release his soldier servant from active service so he could become his valet in the Bahamas. Do you have a valet? He asked me. Alas, no, I said. You should get one. People just don't understand how someone like me just can't function without a valet. I want Fletcher. Piper Alistair Fletcher was in the Scots Guards, and I won't leave till I have him. I said, without really thinking, perhaps I might be able to help. He turned to me and grabbed my arm. Believe me, Mountfield, if you could do anything, Mountstuart, sir, Mountstuart, I'd be most grateful. Why don't I see what I can do, I said. After golf, the Duke won, 3-2, and I wrote him a cheque for £3. I went straight to the embassy and had a cable encrypted and sent to Godfrey at NID. I said that if Piper Alistair Fletcher could be released from active service, I felt sure that the Duke would become far more amenable to all suggestions. Vanderpoel running a temperature of 103 degrees. He still managed to dress me down for sending a cable without his permission. "I'm your senior officer," he coughed. Sunday, 14th July. Drinks with Eccles. He's a smooth, plumply handsome man who apparently made a fortune from Spanish railways before the war. I told him about our day on the golf course and the Fletcher moan. "It seems to be bothering him more than going to the Bahamas," I said. "If you get him Fletcher and his trunks of linen from Antibes, he'd be putty in your hands. Eccles looked at me, not very kindly. "Interesting point," he said. "I'll get on to it." We talked circumspectly about the Duke. It's clear that he behaved like a spoilt child, and all one's dealings with him are conditioned by this attitude. If he's in a good mood, all's well. If he's in a bad mood, then he sulks and stamps his foot and won't come out to play. Monday, 22nd July. Invitation to dine with the Duke and Duchess on Wednesday. Vanderpoel insisted that he go in my place, protested to Eccles, who told him not to be ridiculous. So it's non speaks with Vanderpoel, about as adult as the Duke. Vanderpoel seems more or less reserved and spent all the day at the embassy sending cables and trying to look busy. I sit in the sun and read ancient detective novels from the pension library. Wished Freya were here, depressed by the news that Vichy France has severed diplomatic relations with Britain. Was there ever a better example of the lunacy of this war? And here I am hobnobbing with an ex-king. Wednesday, 24th July. On the way to Bocca do Inferno, Eccles warned me not to sign the Duke's visitor's book if I was asked. Also, he said not to breathe a word about the NID. Apparently, German agents have been putting about the rumour that the British Secret Service are plotting to have the Duke assassinated. Eccles said he was paranoid and very jumpy. But in fact, he was the soul of good humour and fun, laughing, chatting non-stop, pouring people's drinks. I had a sense of him as he must have been as a young man, and the charisma he wielded so effortlessly. And the Duchess herself was suddenly far more attentive to me, Eccles quite abandoned now. When she talks to you, she puts her face about 2 inches closer than is normal. As a result, even the most banal statement has a quality of intimacy, and when she speaks, you feel her breath on your face. It's a fantastically effective trick. She is no beauty, but somehow this special proximity makes you feel chosen. She has eyes only for you. I saw her at close range, and I must say, her teeth are immaculate. Impossible to get any idea of her figure under the haute couture. She's very skinny, but is she flat-chested? And she called me Logan. It was a big party, full of Espirito Santo's Portuguese friends. The Duke and Duchess feel they have been cold-shouldered by the embassy, and Eccles and I were the only British there. It was a warm night, and we took brandy and coffee out on the terrace. There was great booming and crashing of surf in the darkness. The Duke, smoking a cigar, led me onto the lawn to the edge of the circle of light cast by the house. I said how enjoyable the evening had been and what a pleasure it was to see the lights of Estoril blazing along the coast after the blackout in London. I didn't add this, but standing there in the warm night, it seemed to me as if we were in a never-never land for rich and beautiful people where war was unknown. But the Duke wasn't listening. "I had a telegram from Winston today," he said. "We've got Fletcher. He's coming to join us." "Excellent news, sir. All thanks to you, Mountstuart." "No, really, you're too modest," he said. "I know you must have pulled a few strings. We are really grateful." "Don't mention it, sir." "The trouble is," he went on, "we still can't get those trunks of clothes and linen from Antibes. We desperately need them for the Bahamas, and if there was anything you could do..." "I'll try, sir." As we strolled back to the terrace, the Duchess called me over. She put her face very close to mine, and for one mad instant, I thought she was going to kiss me on the lips. But she said, "Would you sign the visitor's book, Logan?" and showed me where it was on the side table in the hall. "Thank you for everything you did for David," she added in a quiet voice, and touched my arm. I picked up the pen, pretended to write my name, but she had drifted away. Back at the London pension, Vanderpoel has left me a note. "I'm to take a flying boat back to London tomorrow while he stays on. Miserable, jealous little bastard." So, I can tell you that Logan Mountstuart meets up with the Duke and Duchess of Windsor later on in the war, 1942, in the Bahamas. and it all goes pear-shaped. But I'm afraid you'll have to wait till April to find out what happens. Thank you very much.
War seems to interest you quite a lot in a sideways kind of way. Also, the upheavals of war. You've returned to the theme in various books in Africa, in the current one. Well, what interests you in war thematically as well as dramatically?
Well, I think there's one very easy explanation, which is when I was 17 or 18, I was living in Nigeria, which was undergoing its civil war, the Biafran War. And although I was never in any danger or near the front line, it was a very curious place to be in for a teenager, and it had a profound effect on me because I realized that everything I thought I knew about conflict, human conflict, and this was a particularly nasty civil war, was completely wrong. And where had I learned about these things? From books and films and television. And my limited experience of living in Nigeria in 68, 69, 70 made me very distrustful of artistic versions of what war was like, or any country affected by war. But I also think, as a novelist, because I'm a realistic novelist, and I want you to suspend your disbelief and to believe in my characters, to believe they exist and that the worlds they inhabit exist, to put a character in a war zone, you place him or her in an environment where all the norms of civilized life have disappeared, and they are thrown back on their mettle as characters, and we all go through life assuming things will be okay. But if you find yourself in a war zone, that assumption is manifestly not going to be applied. So I know, looking back over my novels, I've done this deliberately, and it's partly autobiographical, and partly it's a wonderful sort of proving ground for the characters you're writing about. In the case of this book, Logan Mountstuart has a very easy war in a way. He goes to Lisbon to see the Duke of Windsor. He winds up in the Bahamas for 13 months. Eventually, he's incarcerated in Switzerland, so he sees no action. But it's in this case more to do with my own curiosity about the Duke and Duchess, who I think are a fascinating couple, horribly fascinating couple, probably truly revolting couple as well. And a murder that took place in the Bahamas while the Duke was governor. And I think I prove in this book that he conspired to pervert the course of justice. So, you know, there goes my knighthood. So that's part of the whole Duke and Duchess Bahamas. But it's because of my experience as a when I was 18, 19, and seeing that country. And seeing, armed men were everywhere. You were constantly stopped at roadblocks, ordered out of your car. People were pointing guns at you. When you're 18 or 19, you know, it's sort of frightening but amazing. Mm. You know, now I'd be terrified. But,
well, one of your through themes in all the work is the way you take a character outside of his own culture and displace them. And from I'm thinking about someone like Lorimer Black, the protagonist in Armadillo, who comes from an Eastern European, possibly Gypsy family, who changes his name from Block, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly, but comes to London, and he's an insurance loss adjuster, and I'm sure you've probably seen the adaptation on TV. But as much as he's working, he's also as a loss adjuster, he's adjusting his own character to fit into the society that he wants to, in a sense, succeed in. And also, novels like An Ice Cream War, or A Good Man in Africa, or Brazzaville Beach, you've got characters that usually come from quite English, quintessentially English backgrounds, who find themselves in cultures they don't understand, and thereby engender a novel. I mean, do you think that's kind of what happens?
I think it is, and I don't like to overanalyze what goes on in my head. But I'm sure it's, again, comes back to the fact that I was born in West Africa and grew up there and spent my childhood there. I never felt particularly at home in Britain or Scotland, where my parents came from. I felt more at home in, you know, a big city in Western Nigeria, which seems absurd now, but that was what I called home. So I look back, again, it's the backward glance that tells you these things, and I see time and again people who are either transplanted or fish out of water or set down in environments that are alien to them and have to make the best way through it as they can. And again, as I say, they have to draw on the resources of their own characters. And if their characters are flawed or ineffective in some way, that provokes comedy or drama or the narrative drive that will propel the novel along. As I say, I don't want to become too self-conscious about it, but I realise that, you know, Logan Mountstuart, the character of this novel, is half English and half Uruguayan. And in the novel I wrote in two before this, Blue Afternoon, the central character is half Scottish and half Filipino. And I keep thinking, and I'm now thinking, what's going on here? What subconscious urge to adulterate the bloodline is happening? And I don't really know. I often write about brothers, and I don't have any brothers. I have two sisters, and I think you know, as Keats would say, that negative capability is the key thing. You're just being able to enter into other lives is what stimulates your own imagination, hopefully makes the book intriguing.
Well, I also think that kind of childhood's a nemesis, really, but it's also the driving force for a writer. Even though you don't write autobiographically, there's something about your background that clearly is a source. And as far as I understand, you went to boarding school at the age of 9. In Scotland, and the rituals of public school life, such as, you know, the tribalism that you find there, the kind of sexual sort of curiosities, the cruelty sometimes, you resurface in your work in the characters who find themselves in places like colonial Africa, and it seems that you're examining not just a way of behaving in a different place, but the etiology of that behavior. And also, the question really is, do you feel kind of ambiguous about that background?
It was thrust upon me, so it was a given in my life. I mean, one of the reasons, you know, because I grew up in Ghana, Nigeria, all the children of expatriate Europeans were sent back to boarding school in Britain. It was just completely normal. It was not anything that seemed overly privileged or overly elitist. And duly, I went to a boarding school and spent 9.5 years in one. And when I came out and started to write, I looked in British literature or art, television and film, for any experience that replicated mine, and I couldn't find it. And so part of the reason I wrote stories and I've written two films about boarding school life was an attempt to just fix that experience imaginatively so that in future times, or anybody now wanting to know what it's like to be in a single-sex boarding school, can look at these films or read my stories and say, yes, this is the documentary truth, because there's been a curious collective act of unremembering, it seems to me, on the part of British writers. Every other aspect of our society is very thoroughly and examined with very clear, unemotional eyes, but the British boarding school experience seems to me to be singularly unrepresented, or if it is represented, it's some sort of ad man's version of it, or some sort of Ralph Lauren style image of boarding school, fanciful, sentimental, and they can be very terrifying and cruel places. And so maybe my 9.5, you know, comparatively trouble-free years gave me an education in that kind of ruthless tribal life that goes on there. But I feel I've dealt with it. It's a closed society. It's like an army barracks or a prison or a monastery, who knows. But it's not a real society. So there are elements in it that have a bearing on the lives we all lead, but it seems to be an artificial world at the end of the day.
Yes, yeah. Well, I'm thinking about a film like Good and Bad at Games, which you wrote some time ago, which was kind of a dark take on public school life. And then latterly, the adaptation, which I thought was tremendously successful, of Armadillo, which is... It's by no means similar territory, but it's lighter. There's a kind of comedy. Your comedy has been developing as a writer for at least 10 years as a way of dealing with similar subjects, but from a different textural point of view. And the other point about Armadillo, which was interesting, I think, is that the novel is a third-person narration, and Lorimer Black is your protagonist. And in the adaptation, he gets turned into a kind of first-person narrator because you have an actor. You know, so the audience has a direct kind of relationship with this character, and he's very sympathetic. And you've written, you've created anti-heroes quite a lot. I'm not sure why you are attracted in the vehicle of an anti-hero.
Well, I think it's, flawed people are more interesting than perfect people. Could you write a novel about a saint? I suspect not.
Not a comedy, anyway.
Not a comedy, maybe a very boring novel. It's, you know, the devil has all the best lines, is the old adage. And similarly, Logan Mountstuart is a deeply flawed human being, as we all are. You know, and I think it's more honest to deal with human failings as well as the successes and the times that he behaves well. I mean, it's interesting. Lorimer Black is somebody who's trying to reinvent himself, and the novel film comparison is illuminating. And it's interesting that you say he's a sympathetic character, because he is in a way living a lie. We were rather worried that film, which is a much simpler way of telling a story than a novel, would present him unsympathetically, and so we rely, or you rely, on the inherent charm and attractiveness of the actor to do that work for you. You can also use certain devices like voiceover or close-up and things like that to signal, you know, we are on his side, we like him. But there's no guarantee in film that that will come about. Whereas in a novel, it seems to me, these issues are not important. The novel is far less judgmental than film. We don't worry particularly if we like Madame Bovary or not. We don't worry if we admire Leopold Bloom or not. It's just part of the great democratic texture of the novel form. But as soon as you shift to the other medium, all sorts of other issues begin to bedevil you.
I have one more question, and I'll open it up. But I'm interested in how you've managed to really successfully write a kind of cross-genre novel. On one level, you write about ideas. On the other level, you're a great entertainer. And I'm not sure if it's your first-hand experience of film or what it is, but I think generally writers today are more influenced by film than what they used to be. We're competing with different mediums, and so the novel has to be more than what it was maybe in the 19th century. And I think your books have, you know, they read like thrillers, but they're more sophisticated than thrillers. And are you happy with that kind of description of your work?
Well, I think I am. I mean, I think my books are very serious, but I'm essentially a comic novelist, and even that little extract
I'm reading it again after not having read it for several months, I realize that the comedy underlying the events there. And I think it depends on the way you look at the world. And so by placing myself quite consciously in the tradition of the serious comic novel, as I would describe it, you then have an obligation to not so much create belly laughs, but to stimulate the comic receptors in your readers, and also to generate or create a book that people want to read. I mean, there's nothing, in the various aesthetic pleasures that are available to us in the world today, there's nothing more satisfying than being immersed in a book of whatever sort. And I think all writers strive to seduce the reader into their world. And if the reader is successfully seduced, then it's a tremendous sharing of aesthetic pleasure. I know what that aesthetic pleasure is like, as indeed you do. And I think the novelist who spurns that, or who doesn't care about that, who's not worried about boring the reader, or who's not worried about baffling the reader, is going to have to be super talented in order to make a success of it. I think that relationship between writer and reader, it seems to me, that's something that's very particular to the novel. As I keep saying, I keep quoting D.H. Lawrence's definition of the novel, which is, it is the great book of life. And I think that's what draws us to read novels, because it does the human condition better than any other art form, it seems to me. But you can't take that for granted. There has to be an exchange, between writer and reader.
Yeah, I quite agree with that. I think the novel is, we're in competition for constituents, but the novel has something that nothing else can offer, I think.
I think so, especially having worked in other media, having written films, written television, written radio plays, and I'm aware of they can be fantastically successful, but I'm terribly aware of the constraints and the boundaries and parameters. And you write a novel, and you've got limitless freedom and possibility.
Okay, I'm going to open this up. Are there any questions up there? Yes, front. The question, I think, was what's more important, plot or character, to summarise?
Mm. Well, I think people are much more odd than they would like you to believe. I think that's, life is very strange, and fiction, in a way, has a terrible job trying to keep up with what life throws at us. So my feeling more and more is that character is what draws us to the art form, and that applies to the other narrative art forms, theatre and film. We engage with those other lives. I mean, E.M. Forster said the novel is all about story and character. Alas, as he wished it wasn't, but I think it fundamentally is, and I think you ignore that at your peril. Something buried deep inside the art form is about telling a story about believable people. That's maybe your starting point. Whatever happens after that is up to the individual writer. But in my own case, I'm not an autobiographical writer. I mean, I observe the passing parade, and I take tremendous pleasure and relish from all the absurdities and strangeness that I see. But I don't draw on my own life or people I know to provide me with characters in my fiction. I tend to make them up, but of course then they're an amalgam of my experience. And in the story you quoted, the care and attention of swimming pools, which is about a really nutty, self-obsessed pool cleaner in Los Angeles. I wrote that story, and I'd never been to Los Angeles. And I think it was a long time ago. In the early days when I started writing, I threw out the injunction, write about what you know, and I wanted to write about things I didn't know. And I didn't know what it was like to be a slightly insane pool cleaner in LA, but I wanted to write about it. And so you then have to make it plausible, make it real.
Another question? Yeah.
After coming to that
It's very funny because at the end of this book there is a list of his works, and I think, you know, again looking back, I can see that one of the things I've been doing, and I've been doing it particularly in my short stories as well, is playing with that boundary between what is real and what is fictive. And The New Confessions was my first sort of big effort at creating a fictive world that had all the trappings of the real. And in Nat Tate, I went even further. And we had photographs of the characters, we had footnotes, we had acknowledgements to people who never existed, references to museums and collections that don't exist. But it looks fantastically real. I mean, I don't know if any of you have ever seen the little book. It's a beautifully produced artistic monograph. And when I go to New York, for example, in the Museum of Modern Art, I go to the bookshop, and there it is between Tapies and Tintoretto, Nat Tate. And I almost feel like punching the air, because some browser will pull this out and say, you know, Nat Tate, American artist in 1932 to 1960, and start flicking through and see photographs and illustrations. And the trick, or the whole conceit of fictive and real is I think wonderfully kind of encapsulated in that book. And you know, for my next trick, I'm doing the intimate journal number. But I don't know why it is. I think it's to do with something to do with what you were saying, Russell, that there's something about life as we lead it now, and that the world is so strange. We get so much information, so much fact thrown at us, that writers of fiction, in a way, have to compete with that. And I'm doing it quite unconsciously, but I want my fiction to seem as real as something you might pick up in the biography section or read when you open a newspaper. And maybe it's in the air, maybe it's in the zeitgeist at the moment, that sort of urge. But to answer your question, I doubt I'll produce a work of Logan Mountstuart's fiction. When you read what he's written, you'll realise it's pretty terrible. But again, at the end of the book, at the end of the list of his works, which are not very many because he's a lazy so-and-so, the last book is called This Is Not an Exit, Essays in Art and Literature, brackets, in preparation. So who knows, maybe something will appear one of these days.
I'm just reminded of J.G. Ballard's comment that we're surrounded by fictions of all kind, and it's up to the novelist to create the reality. And I think I kind of agree with that.
Yes, I think it's something like that is happening, but we're probably too close to it to analyze. But I'm realizing, you know, 1987 was when The New Confessions was published, and here we are in 2002. And I am consciously, unconsciously working something out there.
Yes.
And I think other writers are as well.
Yeah. Another question in front.
I enjoyed Blue Afternoon. Could you tell me where the idea came from?
Well, just in case you didn't hear it, you know, where did the idea for the Blue Afternoon come from?
It's a strange. All the beginnings of all novels are often very strange, and again, something you can't generate. They kind of arrive, and you recognise that in that moment, in that idea, there is enough material to write a 350-page book. And the Blue Afternoon came about because I was living next door to a surgeon in Oxford a long time ago, and I knew him, and he was a specialist of the gut in John Radcliffe Hospital, and I rarely encountered a man so obsessed with his work. And being a completely squeamish person, you know, you begin to think, you know, what must it be like, you know, to go to work, and I don't know if any surgeons in the audience, but I mean, to go to work, you know, pick up a scalpel and make that incision, and then, you know, rummage around and all the rest of it. And this man was so driven and by his work that he would have worked 7 days a week, but his wife insisted that he stopped working on Sundays and, you know, met his children and generally behaved like a family man. But I would see him on Sunday afternoons, out in his garden, lopping and pruning and grafting and hacking away. And then, sure enough, at the end of the afternoon, he's back up to the John Radcliffe to see how Saturday's patients were faring. And so I became very interested in surgery because my father was a doctor. And apparently, you know, they say about surgeons, you've got good hands or not. Some phrase like the touch of a lace maker and the grip of a bosun's mate. And my father nearly became a surgeon. And so I got very interested in surgery and started to read up about it purely as a result of knowing this man next door to me. And I realized that the really interesting period of surgery for a novelist was when it ceased becoming sort of semi-active butchery and murder, and they started to cure people and heal people. And that happened around about the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, with asepsis and anesthesia. They washed their hands before the operation, not afterwards, and people could be knocked out while they were under the knife. And so in a comparatively short period of historical time, surgeons have become, as anaesthetists would recognize, the prima donnas of the medical establishment. But it's only happened latterly. So I wanted to write a novel about a surgeon during that, on the cusp of that moment. So that was the origins of the idea. It then became a love story. I then decided to set it in the Philippines in 1902, etc., etc. But it came about out of a simple, you know, intense curiosity about what it must be like to be a surgeon. But often the original idea transforms and transmutes into something else, but I can identify that one as just being about surgery.
I know a surgeon in Lisbon, funny enough, and I've had lunch with him 3 times, and each time he's drunk about half a bottle of wine before he goes back to work. And I started to feel irresponsible, you know, joining in with this guy drinking some wine before we went up to cut somebody up. And I think I'll write a book called The Red Afternoon or something. You know. Another question?
Can I take you back to what you said about the novel? What is it about it, about the actual medium, whether it's techniques you use or intrinsic in the medium, that makes it, that would just immerse the reader as opposed to radio?
Well, I think it comes back to a few very basic things. I think it is to do with the storytelling urge. You know, when we hunker down around the fire at the cave mouth and somebody said, you know, a funny thing happened to me today, you know, and people listened. I think there's something incredibly elemental in that, and the novel form as it exists now is the most sophisticated, liberated and generous version of that urge, more so than the most expensive Hollywood movie, I would say, or the most, you know, elaborate work of theatre. You can do anything in a novel. So it takes that fundamental need a response and it delivers it up in the most, you know, when it's functioning well, in the most fantastic way. But more and more, I think it's what I referred to earlier, that I think we go to art for some sort of, I'm putting it very simply, some sort of mirror that's held up to our own lives, whether it's for a thrill or a shock or a romance or whatever. And my feeling is that the mature, sophisticated, well-functioning novel holds up the most detailed mirror to our lives, our 3 score years and 10 on this little planet, better than anything else. And that's why I think, I sound like some sort of zealot here, that's why I think the novel will always survive, because none of the other art forms can get close. And fundamentally, that's what we want to understand, or we want somebody else's point of view, or we want some sort of intellectual guidance. The novel does all these things, and it does it supremely well. And so I think until, you know, we either all become illiterate and nobody can read, or until some phenomenal three-dimensional virtual life can be projected into the corner of our living rooms, I think the novel will flourish as long as there are readers. It really does satisfy that need. And you only need to look at, you know, the current phenomenon, Harry Potter, to see how a very straightforward children's novel can entrance and enthrall, you know, people the world over. I was in New York on Friday when the film opened, in a big cinema on Lincoln Center, and it was full of, seemed to me, hundreds of American children, most of whom were going, "Harry, Harry, Harry," and I thought, this is all because of a series of books, not because of some Hollywood hype. And so I think, you know, I'm being a bit vague and rambly, but something going on there that that I think the novel form answers. And while it continues to do that, it will still seduce.
And also, I think the complex ideas are best imparted through the novel form. In other words, through storytelling. That's a universal requirement, I think, that's still...
Yeah, I agree. And then you can write a novel that's set in the year 3000, that's 1,000 pages long, and you can do anything. And so it can be as abstruse or as entertaining. It's an incredibly free art form compared to the other ones I have practiced, the other narrative art forms I know. You come, the old adage, you know, writing a novel is like swimming in the sea, you know, writing a film is like swimming in the bath. You're sort of afloat, but you're confined and constrained. And I think for a novelist, for a writer or an artist, that freedom is sensational. It can be 60 pages long or it can be 600 pages long. It doesn't matter. It's completely what you make of it.
I think we have time for one more question.
Can I ask about the interrelationship between the novel and the film or the television pilot? Because it seems to become increasingly common for a novel being translated into some other medium. Do you find that acceptable at all?
I do, and I think it's also perhaps bears out what I'm saying, that, you know, again and again, television, film, theatre, radio goes to the novel for its subject matter. Some of these impulses are commercial, but I also think there's a sense in which, you know, if it works as a novel, it'll function in these other media. The thing that happens in an adaptation of any kind, and I've just adapted a short story of mine for a radio play, so it applies from kind of the small scale to the large scale, you know, BBC One or Hollywood movie, is that so much is left out in the adaptation. It's a process of editing down, and so the adaptation bears some resemblance to the original source, but is inevitably a poorer one because it just can't include everything. No, because it's a completely open and obvious decision. You know that the work is going to be reduced and reshaped, but what you shouldn't do, and what happens all the time, particularly amongst critics, is that they judge the film, the play, the TV series by the book. in every case, the book is going to win. You should say, did I enjoy this television series? And if the answer is yes, you know, end of story. It's something that, I mean, there are bad adaptations and inept adaptations, but it's very unfair to judge the adaptation by the source. And I always cite the fact that nobody would go and see Benjamin Britten's opera Billy Budd and compare it to Herman Melville's short story. They would enjoy the two forms, but routinely in film and television, the books are used as sticks to beat the adaptations, which is very unfair, because exactly the same transformation occurs from short story to opera as occurs from novel to film, or novel to radio play, or ballet to epic poem. You know, it's or vice versa, rather. It's two different art forms, different satisfactions, and it's the nature of the artistic world that all art forms borrow from each other. So it would seem to me to be wrong or silly to complain or to demand that no books were turned into films. If they make good films, then fantastic.
Can you influence the way in which you can you?
Well, I can. Luckily for me, because I tend only to either work with people who I know, or I have some sort of vague power to influence things behind the scenes. I've also written and directed a film myself, which is the ultimate influence of writer over director, highly recommended as well. But if you, there are many stories of many, you know, nightmare stories of writers being jerked around and betrayed and so on. But it depends. It depends on who you work with and what's at stake and all that sort of thing. I was very involved in the adaptation of Armadillo. On the level of casting, of soundtrack, even kind of typeface used on the titles, but that's because I was working with a very old friend who was a producer, and I was lucky. But I've also had, you know, really bad experiences where work I've done has been utterly destroyed by some fool. So I know what it's like at the other. But you can't sort of demand that. That it doesn't happen. It will always happen.
Also, the one thing the adaptation had, which the book didn't, was a great soundtrack.
That's right. You should have a CD sort of strapped onto the novel.
Absolutely. Merchandise. I think we should stop. I'm sure the questions will keep on running, but we have to call it a night. And I think if you have copies of William Boyd's novels, William will sign them for you. Or you disappear. So, but short of that, I'd just like to thank William Boyd very much.
Thank you.